Thank you, Kate. I want to just say it's such a joy to be back in Seattle. I must say it's a little cooler here than Georgia. But I don't know what can be more important than talking about, reflecting upon how we can be peacemakers, how we can bring more peace into our world. And as we know, the struggle begins right here, which is, I think, sometimes the biggest challenge. We want to reflect a little bit about this issue of militarism that is so much a part of our world today, throughout the world, not just in Latin America that we're going to be focused on this evening. But I've come to see militarism as another one of those big addictions. Somehow we can become addicted to this issue of militarism and violence. The prophet Isaiah said it so well. He said they will take evil and call it good, he said. They will take a lie and call it truth. And so many of us, myself included, really do not reflect upon decisions that are being made now or in the past. And we buy into that lie and into that evil, believing that we're doing good. And my thoughts go back to Vietnam. It was very easy for me and so many of us to go off to this country we knew so little about. It was presented to us as something noble. We were going to be the liberators. We were going to bring democracy. And this, of course, was what brought us to Iraq, Afghanistan, throughout the Middle East and other countries. But something happens along the way. And in Vietnam, we discovered, as we're discovering in other countries, that we're not made for war. Our Creator simply did not make us this way. We have a heart, compassion, conscience, and we simply know that this is wrong. And it was the violence of Vietnam, the madness of it all, that really somehow awakened something in me and so many of us. It was just the beginning. We lost hope, and that's what war does. It kills sisters and brothers. It kills children, so many of them civilians, the majority of those killed. And it kills hope. But something happened. We all start awakening from a long sleep, many of us. I felt in my awakening that God was calling me to the priesthood. I talked to an army chaplain about the priesthood, and he recommended to me the Maryknoll community. And I said, Mary who? I had never heard of this group we have here. Father Tom Marty from the Maryknoll community here in town, longtime friends. And I entered Maryknoll, and they've been my family now for 38 years. But I remember years after I left Vietnam and years after I became a priest, I felt it was important to go back to Vietnam to apologize. And I went, and I spent a month in the country, traveling throughout the country, Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh City, met so many wonderful people, and I was just amazed at how forgiving they were. And in this long conversation with this Buddhist monk, I spent some time at a Buddhist monastery there, and he said, our greatest enemy in life is ignorance. And I think about the words of this holy monk a lot, ignorance, our greatest enemy. We knew so little about the people of Vietnam and other cultures, history so much older than our own. And that ignorance gets us in big trouble. This monk spoke with a lot of wisdom. And I think we all go through life, you know, we're learning. We have so much to learn. And there are so many to teach us. And they have been the great teachers, of course. Mahatma Gandhi, Dr. King, Rosa Parks, Dorothy Day, Cesar Chavez, and on and on. They teach us. And when I went to Bolivia, I remember how the poor became my teachers. They were not like Gandhi, who had books written about them, but they taught me so much. Bolivia was under a brutal dictatorship, General Banzer. And I saw my country there giving guns and training to those who were doing the killing, who oppressed the poor. And it was hard for me to understand that. But there the poor awakened something in me. I became a part of their struggle. And my life had meaning. And it was in my fifth year that I, like many, were arrested. I had to leave the country and became very involved in El Salvador after Bishop Romero was assassinated and four church women were killed, two of them friends of the Marino sisters, Maura Clark and Edith Ford. And what was going on in El Salvador brought many of us here in Seattle and around the country connected to El Salvador. And when we went there, once again, we found our country deeply involved on the wrong side, giving guns and training to those at war with their people. I had never seen anything like El Salvador, such brutality. It was the slaughter of the innocents. I came home, as many did, to speak out. How could we keep quiet? And I'll never forget that humble action. Three of us went on to Fort Benning. 500 Salvadoran soldiers had just arrived to do combat training there. And we wanted to say not in our name. And we dressed as these high-ranking Army officers, Linda Ventimiglia, Larry Rosebaum, who just 2 years ago was killed in Guatemala. And we had with us the last sermon of Bishop Romero. And at night we went near the barracks, scaled this tall pine, and just broadcast his message to the soldiers. Lay down your weapons. Stop the killing. We saw that as a sacred moment. They didn't quite see it that way. We were arrested, sent to prison for a year and a half, but I remember that first action and what we learned, that they could not silence us. They could send us to prison, and some of our folks are there. I'll mention that after a while. But they couldn't silence us. The truth can't be silenced. So many of those great peacemakers have taught us that. And when we went got out of prison, we went back to work. And then shortly after that action, we heard about the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, where they were training these soldiers from 16 countries of these Latin American, Central American countries. And we knew it was important to go there to check it out, to do some basic investigating. And what we found was just so alarming. It kept us awake at night. This school was indeed a school of assassins, as the poor of Latin America described the school. Graduates of this school were responsible, documented later, to have killed Bishop Romero, who raped and killed the church women, the six Jesuits and their two women co-workers, a young woman, Elva, and her teenage daughter, Selena. And the list just went on and on in each of these countries, Guatemala, Bolivia, Honduras. And we decided it was just important to educate ourselves, members of Congress, the media, and just put the word out. We've got to come here and say no. This school should be shut down. And that's when the word started spreading. People in Washington State, out in California, New York, Chicago, Louisiana, the bayous of Louisiana, they came. And we put our feet at the main gate of Fort Benning in November. To keep alive, we said, the memories of the victims, to try and keep their memories alive. To say we don't want our tax money going into this kind of school. That money should be going into schools for our children. And in the early days, we had small numbers there, but those numbers each year began to grow, and now thousands gather. And it's like this celebration of hope. A lot of musicians come in, a lot of speakers. We take over the convention center with all these workshops and teach-ins. We connect. We meet kindred spirits. And we realize that we're not alone in this struggle. Whenever we gather at the main gate, it's always been a tradition to, on that Sunday, after the solemn funeral procession, the crosses that you see here bearing the names of the victims, we march that Sunday, thousands, to the main gate, and we put those crosses on the fence. We turn that chain link fence into this sacred wall. The names are called individually. And then there are always those who go over the fence, through it, or around it. And when we do that, they say we're breaking the law. Those who cross onto Fort Benning say they're following a higher law, a law of conscience, a law that says thou shalt not kill, something that says in our hearts that we should be loving one another and not causing war and suffering and death to others. I'm happy to report that now over 275 of our people have crossed that line and have gone to prison. Washington State is well represented, I must say. Many of you know Father Bill Bixel. He's actually going to be sentenced, as many of you know. What's the date again? 28th of this month. Patty Inman, Fred Mercy, Jesuit brother, Maureen Newman, Vanessa Pustick, Eric Robinson, Sister Miriam Spencer. Are any of you here this evening? Any of our POCs? And I'm also honored to say, actually, that now, crossing the line this last November when we gathered there, four were arrested and sent to federal facilities. And some of your own, Chris Spicer, many of you know Chris, who just actually was transferred to the local prison here. And we're also honored to have Chris's parents, Dave and Marty, with us this evening. Could you stand, Chris? Just, we would like to recognize you. The other prisoners of conscience, as we call them, Nancy Smith, David Amundi, and Father Louis Vitale. I think this is Louis's third time. Louis, many of you might know, he's from the Bay Area. The struggle continues. Our prisoners of conscience, they somehow energize us. They give us hope. They bring more people to the vigil each year. I just want to mention a few signs of hope in our movement, and there are many, but just a few. There's a sea change taking place in Latin America. Just a few years ago at our national meeting, when we're a grassroots organization, made up of lots of college students, veterans, nuns, clergy, military vets, and senior citizens. We have representatives from all of these groups, including labor unions. And we decided to go to these countries of Latin America to meet with their leaders, presidents, defense ministers, indigenous leaders, about pulling their soldiers out of this school. We've visited now some 15 countries, and I'm happy to report after meeting with six of their presidents and many of their leaders, four countries have made a decision to withdraw their troops, and those countries are Venezuela, Argentina, Uruguay, and Bolivia. And it was a special joy going back to Bolivia. It's somewhat of a microcosm of what's going on through Latin America, not in every country, but in the majority. A country where the majority of the people are indigenous. They have now the first ever indigenous president, President Evo Morales. It's wonderful. In meeting there with friends I hadn't seen for years, we got together and we said, you know, reflected, who would have ever thought that today it would be like this? That the people we were visiting in these prisons, some of them are now ministers in the government. Who would have ever thought that the poor would get so organized and there would be this uprising? And who would have ever thought in the Middle East and now in Libya that we're all reading about that there would be this uprising? It's amazing to read in these reports to hear that not even the CIA, with all of the money that we pumped into this organization over the years, they were caught by surprise, they said. They didn't know this would happen. And what we're learning, of course, it's inevitable. You can only oppress people for so long, whether that's in countries or in churches. People will begin to say, basta, enough. Those who are oppressed, those who are struggling for survival, living in those shacks, as most are throughout our world, seeing their children dying before their time, not having schools for their kids or health care, people will eventually say no more, no more. And it's just amazing to see this happening in so many countries. And there is this sea change in our travels that we see in Latin America. And it's so encouraging, it's so encouraging. And what we also heard in many of our meetings, we bring a lot of documentation about this school, names of the well-known graduates. And they often stop us and they say, look, we know this school very well down in Georgia. We have been on the receiving end. And we have something to say to you to bring back to your country. Your country, the United States, often referred to as El Imperio, the empire. You're welcome in our country. Pero no como antes, not as before. Not to come in as we have been doing for so long in so many of these countries to exploit, to enrich ourselves from their vast natural resources and their cheap labor. If you can come in as a partner and work with us to improve the quality of life of our people, bienvenidos. You are welcome. And I think that is the challenge for you and I today. I mean, are we as a country, as a people? I mean, can we actually go to these other countries as a partner? You know, as wanting to relieve, to heal the suffering there. I want to believe, I have to believe that we can. And I have to believe that our president and our members of Congress would want that. But we have to hold them and, of course, ourselves accountable. We're talking about budget cuts. I know you're going to experience a lot of budget cuts here in health care for our homeless, for the poor, for our schools, as we are experiencing in Georgia and every other state. And what we are saying very clearly is every dollar among the millions of dollars from our taxes going into this school down in Georgia, that is a theft from schools for our children. That is a theft from those who are struggling here in Seattle and elsewhere. I was happy to, right off of the plane this afternoon, Greg Speltz and Kevin O'Keefe met me, and we went to the offices of McDermott, Jim McDermott's office, many of you, of course, know, who's been a friend of ours for years. And we met with his staff and the staff members of others in the area. And here's what's going on. We have a new strategy that's just developed. We have come close over the years to shut the school down through a bill in Congress. And now what we're going to do now, talking with members of Congress, we're going to request that President Obama, by executive order, close the school. He has that power, that authority to do that by line item veto. And it was well received in the meeting today. It's been well received where we just started this new strategy. And letters, of course, and calls to your local members of Congress, just reminding them how important this is. And letters to President Obama in Washington are extremely important. We are going to be in Washington, D.C., April 4th through the 11th. There's a little reminder there on the table outside. We are going to be fasting in the front of the White House for 1 week. It'll be a liquid-only fast. This is going to be a short one. In the past, we've had two 40-day fasts on the steps of the Capitol in the early days of our movement. And that was somewhat of a marathon. So this fast for a week beginning August the 4th, going to the 11th, we have quite a few people who will be there, some for that week, and others who might come for a day or two. It'll be what they call a rolling fast. Invite you to, I know Kate's going to be with us and others from the area. Invite you to, look at your calendar. It would be a great blessing to have you with us. That weekend, we are going to have a conference, lots of people, to reflect on this whole issue of militarism and U.S. foreign policy, with a focus on Latin America, but also reflecting on other countries and what's going on. We'll be doing some serious lobbying. We hope to get a meeting or some attention being in front of the White House from our Presidente Obama. We hope to have a meeting with him. Congressman John Lewis, a good friend of his, is a big supporter of ours, and we're hoping to have a meeting soon with them. That's Sunday. The end of the week, we're going to have a mass action in front of the White House. We'd be doing some what we call nonviolent civil disobedience, as we do down in Georgia. And it has, folks here in this area have been doing some important protesting, nonviolent protest against those nuclear subs, and who will be going on trial soon. The struggle continues. We had our first meeting in Venezuela just a few months ago. We brought together all these contacts we've met over the years in these different countries. We had 20 countries actually represented, and we met for a week. And out of our encuentro, our gathering, reflecting, some high priorities surfaced: Colombia and Honduras. You may know that there was a military coup in Honduras 2 years ago. We went there right after the coup. It was important to go there to express our solidarity. And we're going to be going there in early May for 8 days. There's a flyer in the back also. Please take this flyer. We're encouraging people, if you can, to join us on this delegation to Honduras. It's going to be very educational. And we'll be meeting with our counterparts, our partners in Honduras. And for more information, just pick up this flyer, give us a call. You can also go to the website, soaw.org. And lastly, we felt it was important shortly after the encuentro in Venezuela to go to Colombia to meet the people of Colombia. A country, Colombia, that's sending more soldiers to this school than any other. About half are coming from Colombia. There are more union leaders killed in Colombia than any other country in the world. And for that reason, the United Auto Workers and labor unions are a big part of our grassroots movement and are very, very connected to what's going on in Colombia. We'll stop here and just, we're going to have some good, you know, discussion, hopefully. But I just want to say in closing, our hope is strong. We're not going away. We've been in this struggle for a while now. Some have somehow got burnout. Burnout set in. We've got to learn, we've learned along the way to take care of ourselves. This is a marathon, this work for peace and justice. We're not doing this just for a year or two. This should be a part of our lives. This is a part of the lives of our sisters and brothers in these countries. They have been struggling for centuries, for so long in countries like Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, throughout Latin America. They've been at this for a long, long time. And we've got to learn how to take care of ourselves in the struggle. And what I've learned is how important it is to kind of withdraw from the struggle at times, to be silent, to reflect, to pray, and to spend time in nature, and to renew ourselves, and to listen to those voices of others. And so we're hopeful. We're going to keep our hands on the plow. And really, I want to just, as you know, we're all in this together. And you have been a source of much energy and hope in our movement. Gracias.
Thank you, Roy, and we look forward to hearing from you again a little bit later in response to some of our questions. But first, I just want to speak briefly myself when we talk about kind of the new efforts that are happening in Latin America. I had the privilege of participating in the encuentro that was mentioned, and this was meeting with folks from 18 countries in Venezuela over a period of time, and it was really amazing the way we were able to connect with one another and find out what we all had in common. And that really was that issue of militarism in the Americas, and something that we are all concerned about. So it's something we want to confront, and it's also on the kind of the negative side, what do we want to confront? The militarism, and on the positive side, building a culture of peace. And so there are those two faces of the issue, and I want to, as I said, take the privilege of being here at the microphone to ask the first question of Father Roy. And that is Colombia was identified certainly as one of the issues to be addressed, as well as Honduras. And I know that since the Encuentro, you have spent some time in Colombia and were at the gates of one of the bases in Colombia. And I wish you would speak a little bit about that, tell people what you did there and why, and what that experience was like.
Thank you, Kate. Yeah, out of that meeting came this high priority of Honduras, Colombia, and we decided it was very important to form a delegation and go to Colombia ASAP. And we had 8 of us who boarded a plane. Well, most of us met in Atlanta and took off for Bogota, Colombia. In the first couple of days there, we met with our sisters and brothers there, our counterparts. It's so important, of course, and we've been there before in other delegations. We've been there twice before. But those delegations were usually about a week and a half of extensive traveling in the country and days and days of listening to the people there and what this school means to them, what this issue of militarism and U.S. foreign policy means in their daily lives. This delegation was going to be different. It was going to be a couple of days of the listening, very important, but we also wanted now to have some action involved in front of a military base. A big concern, a top priority, were these 7 military bases that are being built up in the country, funded by the United States. This country has received over the last 3 years something like $3 billion, about $1 billion a year. That's a lot of dinero. I mean, a lot of dinero. And they're the largest recipient of military aid in the hemisphere, coming right behind Iraq, Israel, I think it's Saudi Arabia, and now Colombia. And with the support of the local people there, we drove some 4 hours to Tolimaida, one of those 7 military bases they're building up. We didn't know what to expect. We thought as soon as we got out of the vans to unfold our banner in front of this big statue with this soldier, this thing is something like 10 feet tall, looking down on us right in front of the base. We didn't know what to expect, and we held this big banner that we brought with us that said, U.S. military out of Colombia, in English and in Spanish. Well, within minutes, of course, they came. We're right in front of the base. They came and ordered us off the property. And we had strategized and planned, of course, this in advance, what would we do. And we decided that we would stay. We would be willing to be deported, willing to be arrested. In fact, it's a strategy that often calls attention to the issue. And then they brought in another higher-ranking officer to order us off of the property, and we refused. And then they brought in a higher-ranking officer. And then they said the general was on his way. And we just stood our ground and said, we'll be happy to talk with anyone, but we're not leaving. And we spent the day there. It was hot. It was a long day, but I must say we felt that our presence there was sending an important message that in the country were this small group of people representing a big grassroots movement who simply want, in a humble way, to express our solidarity with the people here, who are on the receiving end of our foreign policy and militarism. And we stayed in this modest hotel in this little town nearby, and then the next day, 2 busloads and a number of vans arrived from Bogota, filled with Colombians. And it gave us just great joy that we were not going to be there alone now. Just a small group of gringos. And I must say, it just brought us a lot of joy. And we all got there together. And they ordered us once again, not to, they had a lot more military there this time with those M16s that we provided them, of course. They ordered us not to even get, in a sense, there was just this, there must have been 100 soldiers there. But somehow we were able to, with so many people, to make our way back in front of that base there, and some were able to block it for a couple of hours. It was a good day. It was a good day. They did not arrest us. They knew. And we do believe that they took orders from our embassy there. Not to be arresting these gringos. We had a lot of media there, of course, a lot of cameras to document what was going to happen. And it was going to be reported. We got just overwhelming media attention in a way, very good to see. We had interviews with radio stations. The print media was there. A lot of Latin American stations from other countries picked it up. And it was the next day that we met again, and then we went off back to Bogota for more meetings. And then before leaving the country, we had a couple more days, we decided to go now in front of our U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy. As we know, it's a symbol, really, this big embassy. They're in every country. It's that symbol, like this school down in Georgia is the symbol of U.S. foreign policy and that militarism. This embassy is that symbol. So we went there, and this time we were going to have a little something different. We brought with us this very beautiful T.O. Sam outfit, Uncle Sam outfit, with the red, white, and blue, the big top hat, the vest, the trousers, the top coat. It was classy. We've been having that. We've used it a number of times. We had one we wore out at the Pentagon and in Washington, and this is a brand new one that we finally got to use. And I had the privilege, really, of being dressed as T.O. Sam. And so we went in front of our embassy, and here's Joe Mulligan, the Jesuit, and Margaret Kanapke from Dayton, Ohio, and others in our group. We had, eight of us. They're holding this big banner in front of the embassy. And it's amazing what a little theater and humor will do. We've never really used that often in our movement, but it disarms people. How you can get across a message that's so strong, but yet bring a smile, even from military officers entering the embassy. And T.O. Sam, Uncle Sam, would just go up there and shake their hand and say, thank you in Spanish, muchas gracias, for giving us your country, for giving us your petroleum. That's a big issue there, the oil reserves that we exploit, and other, natural resources. And, of course, the people in the embassy, very upset. They send out one of their workers and wanted to know what we were doing there, who were we. They knew who we were. We gave them, a press release, our names, where we were from. And simply we said to them, take the week off. This is Uncle Sam's embassy. Take the week off with pay. A little humor there, and people would pay us, and we would be shaking their hands. It was a good day. It was a good day. And at one point, Uncle Sam just also said to the police, many of the police gathered, and ordered to arrest those other protesters who were holding the banner, that they were traitors to T.O. Sam. But there was a little humor there, something different. And the next day we met, and then the following day we returned to the U.S. And we'll be going back to Colombia. As I mentioned, in May we're going to Honduras. And give some thought to these delegations, because they're very, very educational. going to El Salvador. So many of us have been awakened, you know, by those delegations. The people there have taught us a lot. Other comments, questions?
This is a very specific question. How far or does the School of the Americas teach anyone, any students beyond Central and South America, or is it only?
It's confined to, you know, the Latin American countries, Central American countries. In years past, there were many Haitians trained there during the days of Aristide, when he was forced out of the country. There were a lot of the military and police forces trained, not at the School of the Americas. Those courses are in Spanish there. It's for the Latin American, Central American countries. There is at Fort Benning another school called the International School. It's here where other countries come to train their soldiers. We learned recently with what was going on in Egypt that many, quite a few soldiers from Egypt trained here. And not to mention, of course, the millions actually over the years, billions of dollars in military hardware that are sent to these countries. I think it's important that we really start doing. I contacted just recently, a couple of days ago, Amy Goodman over at Democracy Now. I'm hoping that there will be more reporting on this international school down in Georgia and the connection to these countries that we're hearing and reading about. There aren't many that are coming from Libya. A lot of those there are the mercenaries, where unlike those coming from Egypt, are more trained in bases like Fort Benning and two or three other places in the United States. But what the media has not been reporting on is this. They do mention about the billions of dollars in military equipment over the years that they are getting from our country, but they haven't touched yet, as I've seen, about their militaries and where they are being trained. This is very important. And if some of you have media contacts here in Seattle, Seattle Times, or know someone that you can contact. We've just reached out to the New York Times, Democracy Now. I call it the Atlanta Constitution simply because Fort Benning is so close, 100 miles away. And we're hoping, though, in the immediate future, to start seeing some good research on this.
And we mentioned kind of the other schools or the other places where we're doing some training, and that's one of the concerns in Colombia as well on those bases, that it's sort of an offshore School of the Americas. There's a question here about ELEA, which is the police training school in El Salvador, and kind of a question is that a positive shift policy-wise, or is it really just more of the same, as the questioner says, is it simply putting lipstick on a pig?
ELEA in El Salvador, the International Law Enforcement Academy. We went there actually 2 years ago, a delegation, to check into ELEA. It was just getting started, and it was a very important meeting, 3-hour meeting, with it's being run by our State Department, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and some other federal organization, FBI. It's all financed by the United States, but what we heard from them was that they were training, they said, Central American law enforcement personnel to fight the drug war. And it was very, very confidential. It wasn't seen much in the paper. They were trying to keep it quiet. And we were quite surprised that they actually gave us so much time. We've talked with someone from our embassy there and someone from the State Department. The Salvadorans, who were, they said, ran the school, said very little at the meeting, and it was very clear who really was in charge here. All paid for, once again, by T.O. Sam, by your tax money. We saw Elea as sort of a preparation for their closing down the School of the Americas, WINSEC, as it's now called, that this would become the new SOA now in El Salvador. Because I must say, the school down in Georgia has become a public relations nightmare for them. Major editorials over the years have appeared in so many newspapers, the New York Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Trib, LA Times, many other newspapers, major newspapers, calling for its closure, referring to this school as a school of assassins, a school for dictators. And the Washington Post, two editorials in the Washington Post calling for its closure. And that's why in 2000, by a very close vote, they changed the name of the school from the School of the Americas to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. We have not been fooled. This school still operating with a few cosmetic changes, but it's still about men with guns. They tell us that they're teaching now democracy. We don't buy it. Many of us in the movement who have been in the military know from experience that you don't learn democracy in the military. Something very important, just a little footnote here, those names that they've always given us in the past through the Freedom of Information Act, those soldiers training here for the last 6 years, they have denied those names to us. And it's very important. We're going through Congress, of course, to get those names with a lot of resistance from the Defense Department, from the Pentagon. But we are going to get those names. They always talk about how transparent they are today. This issue of transparency comes up in our debates. We've had debates in the past with the commandants of the school. And they stress democracy and transparency. One last thing, and we brought this up at our meeting with the congressional staffers today. And they actually brought it up, one of them there. When you look at Latin and all these countries that we go to, you don't have to speak Spanish, really. When you just observe, you just look, and you see the majority of the people wherever you are struggling. They are struggling for survival. They're living on the edge. They need teachers, healthcare workers, agronomists. They don't need military soldiers. They don't need commandos. They don't need guns and tanks. They need food, adequate housing, health care, schools. And really, this is what this struggle is all about. We're hearing this very clearly coming out of Libya, throughout the Middle East, throughout the world, throughout Latin America. This is what it's about. And when are we going to learn that the solution or our response to these other countries will not bring anything good through this militarism, through this kind of training, this kind of school? Guns, hopefully, I don't know when, but I'm hoping one day, I was hoping that we would have learned after Vietnam. We haven't. I was hoping that we were going to learn after Iraq. We haven't. When will we get it? And I think we're going to get it when there are more and more of us who simply start saying, you know, as Chris is doing and so many, you know, there's something we can all do. I will not be silent. And when we join all of these voices together, wow, things happen. Things happen. And if it's happening in countries like Libya and Egypt and all these other countries, it can happen here. It can happen here.
Now, there are more questions, but we won't have time to get to them. If your question was not answered, I encourage you to speak with Father Roy downstairs. And he wants to say something else, and so I will step out of the way and let him do that.
Just one more.
Yes.
I was hoping someone would ask one question about this issue of an injustice closer to home in the church, the Catholic Church. But since it wasn't asked, I'll volunteer an answer. But no, let me just say real briefly that, you know, for 20 years, I and others have been working on this issue of U.S. foreign, some longer than us, of course, many years longer. But in our movement, we've been at this since 1990. And it was in my organizing on this issue and trying to call attention to this injustice in Latin America, in Central America, in our foreign policy there, that I discovered this injustice much closer to my home, in my church. As many of you know, in the Catholic Church, women are not able to be ordained. The Catholic Church teaches that only baptized men can be ordained. And I must say, I began to meet many devout women in the church who shared with me their call to the priesthood, as we do as men. And what I saw here after some reflection and study, and I must say, in our seminary days, for many priests, the majority of us, we've never questioned that teaching. The exclusion of women to the priesthood. It was always the tradition. I grew up in Louisiana years ago. You know, we went to segregated schools, public schools. I grew up in a little town where the schools were segregated. It was the tradition. And what I saw here in this exclusion of women to the priesthood was a grave injustice against women, against our church, and against our God who created men and women of equal dignity and standing and calls both men and women to serve as priests. And so it was necessary to break my silence and to go public and to support women who were no longer waiting after 2,000 years. No. Actually, in the early church, women were ordained. But in the early, like the 3rd, 4th century, the patriarchy really dug in, and women were basically sidelined. And this issue is a big one in the Catholic Church today. This issue of sexism, which I came to see as the root of the problem. And as we know, sexism is wrong, as racism is wrong, as homophobia is wrong. And no matter how hard we may try to justify sexism, racism, homophobia, and all these other forms of discrimination, in the end, it is not the way of God. It's our way. It's called discrimination. And it's wrong. It's wrong. And this church teaching that excludes women from the priesthood is wrong. And after attending the ordination of Janice Severdesinski, one of the women in very active in our movement, one of our prisoners of conscience, inviting me to her ordination down in Kentucky, I wrote and said it would be a joy to attend. And just days after the ordination ceremony, which was joyful, something to celebrate, someone saying, yes, I want to give my life to the church. I want to bring about a better world. Wow, something to celebrate. I received this letter from the Vatican giving me 30 days to recant. My belief in public statements that support the ordination of women, or I will be excommunicated. Latae sententiae, which means automatically. A very serious letter. And I thought about it for a couple of weeks and then sent in my response. I have a copy of that if you'd like it. But I simply wrote back to the Vatican and simply said in different ways and at the very end, in conscience, I cannot and will not recant. And that was over a year now. And that was my belief, my statement then, and that's my belief and statement today, and will be tomorrow. I just want to say, though, in closing, that this movement is unstoppable, like the women's suffrage movement, the abolition of slavery, the civil rights movement. These are movements and movements in the Middle East that we see that can't be stopped. Because at the very root is this hunger for justice, this issue of equality. We are all equal in worth and standing in dignity before one another and our Creator, no matter what our faith tradition might be. We are all equal. And so this movement that I'm a part of now, women, of course, are at the vanguard. But I must say, when you see an injustice with such clarity as I see this one, there's no way one can be silent. There's no turning back. And I'm not quite sure how the Vatican, I've got a meeting coming up soon, not quite sure what they're going to decide, but when we follow our conscience, as we've all experienced, we're free. We're free. We can sleep well at night. And tomorrow, let me just say, I'm sorry, Saturday, we'll be showing the first documentary. It actually hadn't been released yet, but we have certain select showings. I have a copy. It's called Pink Smoke Over the Vatican. It's going to be shown Saturday at the
2100 building just off of Rainier.
At what time?
3 p.m.
3 p.m. Invite you to come if you'd like and have some discussion about that injustice. And also, and again, I just want to thank Kate and Greg and everyone really here who've just worked so hard and continues to work for justice. In the back, there's this documentary, compilation of our DVDs about the SOA watch and the movement in the school down there. The flyers that I mentioned are all there. Please take them and spread the word. We hope we can have more people joining us on the delegation down in Georgia. I'm sorry, in Honduras. And then in April, hope to see you in Washington, D.C. But thank you very much.